attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea either.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by a returning guest, someone who has been a returning guest previously. This is his third appearance on the podcast. So welcome back, William Kajani, who is the elections, politics and policy analyst for Star Sports. Welcome back to the podcast.
A pleasure to be here.
So to begin with, I'd like to ask, what was your initial reaction to that exit poll?
Not shock, more sort of awe at the actual size of the majority. Mm-hmm. I think most people, and certainly the sort of betting we've been having for the day, thought that there'd be a reasonably sized majority, a bit of leeway. This was a very seismic, very historic result, definitely, and you could feel that drop right at 10 p.m. Because I was at ITV. So the whole room just went agape. Not the fact it had a majority, it was expected in hindsight, but just how big it was.
Mm. What was the sort of like betting predictions that you had immediately prior to the election poll dropping? I mean, you said that expected a majority, but obviously not on that scale. What sort of majority were you expecting?
We were 11-4 about both a Tory majority of 1-24 seats and 25-49 seats. Anything above that was considered a bit not outlandish, but it was 7-2 for 50-74, and we were 7-1 for a 75-99 Tory majority. And I think, you know, that really, to many people, I think would have exceeded expectations, certainly on the market basis. Where we saw the money come in, it actually exceeded the expectations because we took free bets and we took them on majorities of 1 to 24, 25 to 49 and 50 to 74. Mm. So that was beyond, I think, expectations of the market. And the market had never really rated the chance for hung parliament that highly. Mm. It moved in an interesting way. I think it went off something like a 9-4 shot, having been 11-4. It touched 7-4 through the day. But even then, the market was pretty certain it was going to be majority. It was just, you know, how big was it? And that was bigger than expected.
Mm. Why do you think that, I mean, obviously some of the polling had quite considerable leads for the Conservatives, but a lot of the polling obviously had smaller leads, sort of like a smaller majority, or even, as you mentioned, going into a hung parliament. Why do you think that perhaps the scale of the majority wasn't quite picked up, either in terms of the betting market or in terms of polling?
People, I think, sort of... I mean, first of all, we look at the polls. The polls, on average, were actually pretty bang on. Mm-hmm. It was a 10-point lead, and the 10-point lead can more than translate into nearly 400 seats, mm-hmm. depending on where the marginals went. And all the marginals, all the small marginals went the Conservatives' way. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Lib Dems didn't break through in the South West, so there you're adding a lot to the 317 seats that they already took, you know, gain of about 50. A 10-point polling average is roughly an expectation with that. Mm-hmm. And most of the polls recently, they averaged leads of 5-13, but most of them were at least 7 or 8 points upwards. So good lecture for pollsters. For the betting market, why did it exceed expectations? I think that punters were a bit sceptical about the Tories taking all of the marginals through the red wall. The punters expected Labour also to win some signature seats. We took bets on Labour winning Chingford and Woodford Green, two lumpy ones on the day. We took £800 in them winning Barnet. Mm-hmm. You know, punters were never expecting them to win in Bolsover, for instance, you know, which was a stunning result. It wasn't even close. Mm. And I think the punters in general have been following the narrative of the campaign. And the narrative of the campaign suggested Tory majority, but not thumping landslide.
Do you think that we heard prior to Election Day quite a lot of talk about turnout? Voting turnout, I think, was a bit down. But we also had a lot of people talking about people registering to vote who hadn't previously registered to vote. And a lot of people in the Labour Party camp thought that that would help them, that would mean that they would do well. Do you think that in terms of turnout, it's, for the time, quite a good turnout? And also, do you think that in terms of people who registered to vote, that a lot of those who registered to vote might have gone Conservative rather than Labour?
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible. The actual election studies will be really interesting to see. The Ashcroft election study suggests that Labour has still a big chunk of that youth vote, something I think like, I think it's 57% of 18 to 24-year-olds, and that they also won the under 45, so basically, we presume renters, people attempting to get onto the housing ladder. Mm-hmm. But if you look actually at the, but if you look actually at the sort of turnout overall, and also where Labour had high votes, it's possible, and this is an anecdotal thought, but it's possible they were all built up in cities. Say, for instance, Canterbury, which, going by the whole set of results, should have gone Tory. Mm-hmm. It was a Labour marginal. Rosie Duffield had only had, I think it was less than 500 votes in hand. And the Tories won nearly 400 seats overall. You'd expect that to flip back. There were students queuing out all day for the polling station. The uni had to get tarpaulins to keep people dry. Mm. And she ended up increasing her majority. Now, that's anecdotal, but it suggests quite strongly, perhaps, that if there were first-time voters, if there were young voters who were energised, they built up the vote in cities and not in towns and communities, which is where the damage was done.
Mm. You mentioned Bolsover a couple of minutes ago. Was there a particular result that really shocked you? I mean, was it Bolsover? Was it another seat?
There were quite a few. I think the margin of defeat in Bolsover more than anything shocked me, because usually when those seats flip, it's because of a really concerted on-the-ground effort, and it's sort of a bellwether, right? And it happens by a slim margin. Say, for instance, Jay Swinson, who was beaten by, I think, 154 votes or something. Mm-hmm. Dennis Skinner is one of the most famous MPs in the country. I think he is close to the father of the house. He might have become the father of the house after Kane Clark left. Mm. And he was thumped. 5,224. By modern standards, is a pretty thumping win. And I think that was sort of the icing on the Tory cake. Blythe Valley was one that shocked me. I'm not shocked that the Tories won Kensington for the intense symbolism, but I am shocked at how clearly mismatched the tactical vote was that led the Tories in. It summed up, I think, a lot of the Lib Dem campaign, which was very much that they lost their way tactically when the election was called. And I think in hindsight, I don't know if it would have, don't think it would stop the Tory majority, but in hindsight, the gap between Labour and the Liberal Democrats was one of the underrated factors of this election.
Hmm. So do you think that, in effect, it was tactical voting that really did in parties like the Liberal Democrats at this election?
No, because the Liberal Democrats increased their vote share a fair bit. The problem was they ran a bad campaign. I think it was not done with, there was not a lot of foresight on it. They tried to make, I mean, Brexit was the big issue of the election. When their vote was divided, they needed to go about it in a different way. I think they were trying to become the second party. Now, it worked in the local elections and the European elections, but different systems, and now you have first past the post, and I don't feel there was a lot of acknowledgement of that. I think also Joe Swinson spent a lot of her time attacking the Labour movement, including Corbyn, quite widely. And in the end, come home in the numbers expected. If 16% of the Tories overall voters voted Remain, it didn't come home, I think, to the point where they would have really had a good election, because they didn't break through in the southwest and they didn't break through in the southeast. I know they were denied a couple of seats because basically they couldn't get their candidates through the first preference in tactical voting. Finchley, Cities of London, Westminster, but overall, don't think he did them in.
Now, you said earlier that you think this is sort of a political watershed moment. Looking to the next election, do you think that we're going to see another likely Conservative victory just based on the electoral map as it is at the moment?
I think if you had one in, say, a year or so's time, maybe a few months or so's time, that'd be the case. These sort of things are always a bit tricky to predict. I mean, number one, after the next election, we will certainly have had some form of Brexit. It is certainly likely to be reasonably hard. Mm-hmm. The issue is do you go down route number one, which is a withdrawal agreement, and then everything in the future relationship is negotiated. We end up with very much a third party state that looks and feels something like, say, an Australia or a Singapore model, mm-hmm. which is, I think, what the libertarians who are very close and influential in the Tory party really want. Or do we have a situation which looks potentially quite likely, which is the withdrawal agreement is passed overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. We then go into future trade negotiations. We do not have the time simply to cover everything within the 9-month deadline. And Johnson, with the numbers to do whatever he wants, decides to honour his promise of not extending the transition. And we leave with no deal in December. Mm-hmm. If we leave with no deal in December, I'm of the opinion it will be quite a shock still. People will be better prepared for it, but it will still be quite a seismic shock. If there are, say, the job losses on the manufacturing scale and industrial scale, perhaps even in services, that most experts tell us there will be if we leave with no deal, that could leave quite a deep wound in the seeds that make up the Tory advantage. But this is really long-term thinking. I mean, first past the post suits the two major parties, sure. But as for the electoral map, seeing the Tories, I don't honestly know about that. I think they won this resoundingly, and it goes beyond the voting system, and it probably goes beyond most other things that people would go for. You know, I think the deep dive into how people voted would be really interesting. Opinion will always also come out with some stats saying that people didn't like the Labour leadership, but it's too simplistic to blame this on anything solely, although I think Brexit was the biggest factor.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously next year we're going to be seeing two leadership elections, so to begin with I'd like to talk about the Liberal Democrats' leadership contest next year. What are we sort of looking like in terms of betting for that election? Has there been any immediate odds calculated, or are we going to have to wait a bit to see where the market is going to go in terms of who the next Lib Dem leader will be?
We had odds pretty much after the exit poll. Mm-hmm. They changed a fair bit because Ed Davey is now even. Now he's sharing the interim leadership with Sal Brinton. I don't think keep it like that. Now I think they'll want to go to an MP. You can get even Ed Davey, which is just directly a 50% chance, half a chance basically, in really crude terms, that he will win. You can get 6-4 for Leila Moran, and then there's a big gap. And that's the reading we think of where the two parties, where the two people in the party, I should say, are. Moran probably was seen by them to have had a good election beforehand, and 6-4 roughly calculates basically that she's got around 42% chance of taking, which which I think is entirely fair. I think also it's fair that we've got a big gap between them two and Wira Hobhouse.
Mm-hmm.
12-1. Then Christine Jardine is 20-1. Then it's Sarah Olney, who's also 20s. We don't know too much about the internal thinking here. Davey was certainly quite liked, certainly popular.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-election, Moran also was a long time Lib Dem. She didn't sort of defect and jump in. I'd be surprised if it was one of either of those two, the punters at the moment, like Davey. But they're back top two in the market, to the exclusion of everything else.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the Liberal Democrats are going to, as you said, that they increased the amount of share that they had per constituencies, but how do you think that they're going to recover from this election? In what sort of direction do you think they will go in terms of policy and in terms of image?
In terms of policy, it's probably got to be... I mean, the thing was, they actually had a fairly radical manifesto. If you look at the spending plans,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't that far behind Labour. It was certainly miles away from the Conservatives. And it suggested a rather bold offering, sort of aggressive social liberalism. Now, the issue is where does the Labour Party go? That probably informs a bit the choice. The Labour Party, a lot of people want it to be back to the centre ground, but a lot of people in the charge Labour Party, they say no. I think the fact it's going to be heavy on sort of progressive and social liberal ideas is reflected by the fact that we've got Ed Davey and Len Moran as first and second favourite in our markets.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of policy, the key will be to try and occupy a space where they're not basically Labour light, because that was a big criticism of the Lib Dems, which was quite effective during the campaign. And with Brexit being likely to be done, you know, in 5 years, you are not realistically going to be, I think, pushing for re-entry with the same fever that people have been for now. You know, it feels done. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going to try very much and go to a sort of 2005-style position.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the Labour Party, and of course they will be having a leadership and a deputy leadership election next year. I'd first like to have a look at the deputy leadership election. What have the markets been saying regarding that? Are there any runners and riders at the moment? What are the sort of odds at the moment?
Well, we've only got some odds on the main one, that mm-hmm. being at... people are declaring at the moment to run for leader, and that's what all the talk's about.
Mm-hmm.
When we get an idea of who's likely to actually put their hat in the ring for deputy, probably we'll have a market on that.
Mm-hmm. Turning then to the leadership, we've seen a lot of people suggest people like Angela Rayner, Rebecca Long Bailey. What's the market saying in terms of odds? Is there a particular favourite at the moment? What's it looking like?
It's Keir Starmer who's favourite. He opened up, he was 3-1 on the night of the election blowout. He's now 5-2. Mm-hmm. That's 28.57% chance, basically, we give him of being the next Labour leader. Rebecca Long Bailey is 9-2. That's an 18.18% chance. Now, Jess Phillips, who was 16-1 on the night of the election, and was 33-1 in the summer when we took £500 on her, has crashed in to 5-1. In other words, just over 16% or 16.67% chance of becoming the next leader. Now, that's a really big move, and we have seen lots of money for her. She's been the best back by a mile, presumably on the basis that we think she's going to run, presumably on the basis that the election result is bad enough that people might want Labour to change course.
Mm-hmm.
And also presumably on the fact that this has been an ambition of hers for a little while. Now, with Phillips, there's the issue of turning the membership into her favour, because a lot of Labour members aren't big fans of Jess Phillips, mm-hmm. who was after Corbyn for quite a long time and went after Corbyn quite hard. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. particularly as this leadership election is probably going to take place, say, April of next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a lot of time, basically, for people to flood the party with memberships. You know, we can have to presume it's the existing electorate internally in the Labour Party that will pick its next leader. Lisa Nandy is coming from 20 to 1 to 10 to 1. People are really getting behind her now.
Mm-hmm.
So Rainier is another big mover. Was 12 to 1 just before the election, 11 to 1 on the night of the election, now 7s. And we've seen a drift in Emily Thornberry, who was 12 to 1 just before the exit poll, and 12 to 1 on the morning after, now 16s. That might be because of her fervent pro-European stance, which one that we see as being so popular.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the first three that you mentioned, Keir Starmer, Rebecca Long-Bailey, and Jess Phillips, how do you think, if they were to become Labour leader, how do you think that they would differ from one another? What do you think, stylistically and policy-wise, would separate them from one another?
Well, if you have Rebecca Long-Bailey, you definitely have sort of a manifesto in the name of sort of for the many, not the few. It probably, I mean, in 2024, presumably, it will probably ask for a very sharp reversal of Tory orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking it would still call for nationalisation, which, by the way, people do like the sound of. When you actually poll people on just the policies of nationalisation, they support most of it. And I think the sort of campaign will very much be momentum-led, perhaps maybe not youth-focused as, mm-hmm. as much, because the turnout wasn't what they hoped it'd be this time. But I can see it being, you know, same sort of the same as now, but perhaps with a bigger focus on towns and communities. I think if Angela Rayner was leader, Labour would make an explicit point of trying to appeal maybe to not just swing voters, but people who perhaps have traditionally voted Tory, to try mm-hmm. and pull and move them over back to Labour in the same way that you might say Blair, etc. did. Not with the same policies, but the same sort of style of attack. If you had Keir Starmer in charge, it'd be really interesting to see, because he carries himself well in the eyes of the party membership, even though he's not, you know, explicitly as left-wing as the others. Lots of people say they like him. I think with the Keir Starmer Labour leadership, it will be left of centre and pragmatic. So it might be Miliband-ish, if you speak off the top of my head here. With Lisa Nandy, we know what the off would be. Huge, huge appeals to towns and communities that left Labour in their droves. Yesterday. I think Labour probably needs to do that. With what policies, we don't actually explicitly know. I get the feeling that Nandy would have lots of left-leaning policies that weren't explicitly as ambitious, say, as the current manifesto.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the direction of the Labour Party then is based on the way that the seats that were held, is that we're going to see more focus perhaps on southern seats like Canterbury and Warwick and Leamington, rather than perhaps the traditional battlegrounds that we saw go Conservative at this election? Or do you think that in actual fact that the party is going to put as much emphasis as it can on getting those voters back in the north west, the north east of England?
I think the electoral map dictates they have to go and win at least a significant majority, like at least, let's say, 60-70% of mm-hmm. those towns and communities back. The north west did damage, I think, and also, there needs to be a better offer in Wales. Now, I know Plaid Cymru lost a seat and the Tories did well there, but of course, the Leave voting sentiment is much higher. Now, this is all hypothetical because presumably by the time the next election, Brexit's been done. And whatever effect it's had, good or bad, we fell for 2 or 3 years. If Brexit was to go badly, there are different degrees of badly. It's quite likely that some of those voters could be won back.
Mm-hmm.
If it was to go well, that's a much harder task, seeing as they got what they wanted and it was brilliant, let's say. I think the route back to Labour probably has to lie through going to the North West and the Midlands, and then hopefully turning a bit of Wales back as well. I mean, they did lose a couple of seats in London and the outlying areas, but I think that as a whole, cities tend to have more Labour sentiment in them, purely because of the demographic trends of people getting better educated, becoming more socially liberal,
mm-hmm.
and you know, moving to a city and voting Labour, especially if they can't afford to buy a house there or something, you know. And sometimes you get the migration effect of people can't live in London, going out and settling up in places like, you know, I don't know if it's in London exactly or Putney, etc., you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming to the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on again, William. Thank you once again. So I'd like to ask you one last question. Now, last time you appeared on the podcast, I asked you what you would like for Christmas this year. I'm now going to ask, what would you like for Christmas next year?
Ooh, this is interesting. Christmas next year. I tell you what, I'd love to avoid no-deal Brexit. I'll take that, actually. A non-no-deal Brexit for Christmas next year.
Well, I think that's something that most of our listeners could agree to as well, and I think it would be something that would be better avoided than something to happen. Thanks once again for coming on.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
If you would like to listen to the podcast, you can do on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube or Spreaker. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can do at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do @debatedpodcast. Like us on Facebook, same, Debated Podcast. Thank you once again for listening to this episode. I hope you listen to the next one.